From Nebraska to Alabama, Missouri to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, with the United Kingdom about to leave the European Union, talks are underway on a new U.S.-UK free trade agreement. Dan Griswold from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with details. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth says there was both a blue wave and a red wave on Election Day. He joins us with the real story. The GOP survived the midterm elections with Senate gains and historically moderate losses in the House. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores whether the GOP has now become the party of Donald Trump. And the battle raging across the nation is more than just the usual partisan political wrangling. It is a fight between liberty and big government. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The United States has a historically unique relationship with the United Kingdom. As the UK prepares to exit the European Union, the opportunity is at hand to forge a new free trade agreement that will cement those ties. Dan Griswold is a senior research fellow and co-director of trade and immigration at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He is here to talk about that trade relationship. Dan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Dan, before we talk about a potential free trade agreement between the United Kingdom and the United States, Brexit. It is a subject that has been brought up on this program many times before, but it's been a while. First of all, what is Brexit and where does it stand?
Yeah, the situation is fluid. You know, the British public voted in June of 2016 to leave the European Union. Great Britain had been a member of the European Union since 1973, and that has all sorts of implications. But as a member of the European Union, the United Kingdom had basically delegated its whole trade policy to Brussels, right? They have a customs union, so there's one external tariff for all 28 members. But if they're leaving the European Union, then Great Britain will be free to negotiate its own trade agreements with other nations. And that'll happen in March of 2019. There may be a transition period where they remain part of the customs union, but sometime not long after that, they will be free to enter into free trade agreements with other countries. And the United States, for obvious reasons, is a very high priority for Britain to negotiate a free trade agreement with, because we're such important mutual commercial trade partners.
Let's talk a bit about the size of that partnership. In terms of the size of the economy of the United Kingdom, how big is it and how important is it to the United States?
Yeah, Loman, there really is a special relationship between the United States and the UK commercially as well as in other ways. Great Britain is the world's fifth largest economy. There are 65 million people there, $2.6 trillion economy. And we do a lot of commercial dealings with people in the United Kingdom. It's interesting, in terms of goods trade, they're number seven in the world. But in terms of services trade, so financial services, transportation services, they are our number one trading partner. We sell more services to people in Great Britain than we do to any other country. We buy more services from them than any other country. And also in terms of foreign direct investment. Now, direct investment is where the investors own a controlling interest. So think of an affiliate in the other country that's controlled by the parent company in the other country. They're our number one source of direct investment in the United States. More than a million Americans go to work every day in the United States for companies owned in Great Britain. And we're the biggest source of foreign direct investment in Britain. More than a million Brits go to work every day for American companies. So there is opportunity to liberalize trade, and there are some remaining tariffs that we should get rid of on day one of any agreement on goods. But some of the best opportunities for a free trade agreement are in services liberalization, such as financial services, and in foreign direct investment, encouraging more cross-border investment in our two countries.
And I would like to add, for those who may not be familiar, when we talk about the United Kingdom or Great Britain, we're talking about England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, all part of the United Kingdom. And Dan, if we look at a free trade agreement between the United Kingdom and the United States, of course, historically, we have many ties to England and Great Britain. What would be the benefit to American interests, American businesses, American workers to having such an agreement?
Well, first, they're an important export market, so we'd benefit as producers. And the European Union is generally open to trade, but they have some remaining tariffs that are significantly high on agricultural products. For one, they have an average tariff of 11%. My hope would be a U.S.-UK agreement would bring that down to zero. Same on the U.S. side. We have an average 5% tariff on agricultural products. Dairy products are particularly protected in both countries. I'd like to eliminate those duties entirely. Automobiles. The European Union imposes a 10% duty on imported automobiles. We should get rid of that. We impose a 2.5% duty in the United States, a 25% duty on light trucks. That should go to zero. We do actually do a surprising amount of passenger vehicle trade with Great Britain. And so eliminating those tariffs would allow consumers and producers to specialize and benefit from that. So there are a lot of opportunities in terms of encouraging investment, bringing investment into the United States and creating jobs and vice versa in Britain. So there are a lot of opportunities. Generally, we have free and open trade and investment with the European Union and with the United Kingdom. But there are some significant exceptions, and this agreement provides a great opportunity to sweep those away and leave our people free to do business with one another.
What impact, Dan, would this have on people, on labor? Would it also make it easier for somebody in the United States to go to work in the United Kingdom or vice versa?
Yeah, it wouldn't have a huge impact in the sense that we're a $20 trillion economy and barriers are already pretty low. So I wouldn't exaggerate the positive impact or any negative impact it might have on particular sectors. But it would incrementally increase the freedom of Americans to buy and sell with people in Britain. And yes, you bring up an interesting issue of the movement of people. Britain's not a huge source of permanent immigrants to the United States, but they are the number five source in the world for temporary work-related immigration, you know, intercompany transfers. One of the proposals I have in my paper for Mercatus is that we have free movement of people between the two countries. I mean, we have a common language, a lot of common cultural assumptions. There shouldn't be any misgivings about that. We have an agreement with Australia to create a special visa after we joined a free trade agreement with Australia in 2005, and that allows up to 10,000 professionals from Australia to come to the United States and work. I propose we have that same system with the UK. If you want to cap it, 30,000 would be proportional to their population. I don't see any reason to have any cap. Let movement of people go back and forth to fill jobs, to fulfill service delivery of services, and that would be good for Americans too. We could go over to Britain and work, and I think it'd be a great advantage for people in both countries.
We have been talking with Dan Griswold, who is a senior research fellow and co-director of trade and immigration at the Mercatus Center, which of course is at George Mason University. Dan, tell us a bit about Mercatus. Also, where can folks go if they'd like to read your recent study on this issue?
Yes, the Mercatus Center is a nonprofit educational institution. We promote market-oriented solutions to the challenges of society rather than government-oriented solutions. People can find all our research at mercatus.org, and if you click on trade and immigration, you'll find everything produced by my department here at Mercatus.
Dan Griswold of the Mercatus Center. Dan, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman.
Andy Roth watched all the election results at the Club for Growth. And Andy, it appears the blue wave didn't really happen, although Democrats did take control of the U.S. House of Representatives. But first of all, let's talk about the U.S. Senate. Give us the scoop on what occurred and what the impact will be.
You mentioned blue wave. I think the blue wave did occur. I just think that there was a red wave that really tamped it down. I think there was a lot of voter enthusiasm on both sides, and for a while there, I think the GOP was worried that the Republicans weren't going to turn out. But they did turn out in a lot of places, and especially in the Senate, as you mentioned. They picked up seats in North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, and hopefully, once the recounts are done, in Arizona and Florida. So there's five pickups right there. We did lose Nevada, so at the end of the day, it could be a net pickup of four seats. That means that the Senate would then look like 55 to 45 Republicans, and that's a good healthy margin, especially if we have a Supreme Court nominee in our future, or just trying to confirm judges all over the place. Because now with a Democrat House, it's going to be very hard to do legislation that's very pro-growth and will limit the size of government, because the House Democrats are certainly going to try and run with their agenda, even though it's going to come to a screeching halt in the Senate.
As you mentioned here, the House did flip to the Democrat Party. That's a normal thing for a swing like that to occur in the first midterm after a president is elected. In terms of margins, was this one of the bigger swings or one of the smaller swings?
The Democrats have picked up 29 seats, and there's probably about 11 or 12 seats still undecided. But Republicans have half of those, so maybe the Democrats pick up 32, 33 seats. Against expectations, that's pretty good. I think Republicans were worried that it could be over 30, maybe 40 seats, and certainly with a blue wave, more than that. But they were able to keep it down. So I think that's pretty good. The Democrats, they have 225 seats as of now in the House, and you need 218 in order to pass legislation. So there are seven, so they can only afford about seven defections. Now, there were several Democrats who won in red districts, Trump-winning districts, and they also are, you know, sort of reform-minded Democrats who vow not to support Pelosi for Speaker. I could see them, if they are being honest and forthright with their campaign promises, not going along with a lot of the Democrats' agenda. And so that could make it very difficult for the Democrats to pass a lot of their top priorities. So it will be very interesting to see what happens in the House early next year.
Let's talk a little bit more about that speaker race. You do need those 218 votes in order to elect a speaker. And I did hear one commentator had tallied up something like 29 of the Democrats who won had indicated they would not vote for Nancy Pelosi. So what happens in that race, Andy? If you have, as you pointed out, they have about seven seats to play with. If you have a dozen or more Democrats who actually honor their campaign commitments and Nancy doesn't get to the requisite number of votes, what happens?
Yeah, actually, I've been saying for some time that the most underreported story out there is that Pelosi's not going to be Speaker. If I was in Vegas, I would bet that she is not going to be Speaker. Part of that assumption resides on me thinking that these new Democrat freshmen are good for their word, and I could be sorely disappointed. I'm pretty jaded about D.C. politics, but on this, I think that they do have to keep their word, because they are in districts that are right-leaning. Now, they could wiggle out of it. One of the things that they could do is they could have the vote for Speaker is on the floor, and it's very public. And if no candidate gets 218, then the parties retreat to their cloakrooms and try and figure out another strategy for the second ballot. So a lot of these freshman Democrats could say, yeah, I pledge not to support Pelosi, but only on the first ballot. We're now on the second ballot. I now support her. That's the sort of wiggling out that I could possibly see them do. But if they stay rigid and say, I'm not voting for her, then somebody else has to emerge. And I would have said it was Joe Crowley from New York, but he lost to that bartender socialist lady, the 29-year-old, in the primary. So he's obviously not available. So the Democrats are going to have to find somebody. And it's possible that it could be more of a Clinton moderate Democrat type who isn't going to overplay their hand over the next 2 years like Pelosi did in 2009, 2010, which caused the big Tea Party wave in the following election. So I think the next speaker could be someone who's a little bit more moderate, a lot younger, because they're going to want to represent the new generation of Democrats. But I could be completely wrong. It could be Pelosi. It could be Steny Hoyer. Both Pelosi and Hoyer have announced that they're running for Speaker and House Majority Leader. So we'll see what happens.
We have been talking with Andy Roth of the Club for Growth. And Andy, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Despite the vitriol aimed at Donald Trump, Republicans fared reasonably well in the midterm elections. Does this mean the GOP is now the party of Trump? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores.
The days after midterm elections tend to lend themselves to sitting presidents delivering frank assessments of what are typically pretty poor performances by their parties. Back in 2006, you may remember George W. Bush described his party's losses in that year's election as a thumpin', and Barack Obama in 2010 said that Democrats were handed a shellacking when they lost more than 60 seats in Congress. President Donald Trump on Wednesday held a press conference in the White House, and although his remarks shared his predecessor's candor, there was really none of that humility. Instead, he rattled off a list of candidates who had won after Trump himself had campaigned on their behalf. And then Trump turned to some of his fellow Republicans who he said didn't want the embrace from the Trump White House so close to the election. And, well, he kind of let them have it. It was a stunning moment, and I think it's worth exploring a little more what that means and what the sort of results of the midterms mean for the Republican Party in the next 2 years, a party that is now very much the party of Donald Trump. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, as I said, we're taking a look at the midterm results and really, I think, trying to assess what some of the changes within the Republican caucus, both in the House and the Senate, will mean for the next 2 years. And the reason why I started this by talking about Trump's remarks at the White House on Wednesday is because one thing that he said to a number of Republican lawmakers, but in particular, one thing that he said to Representative Mia Love of Utah really jumped out to me. And so here's the clip of Trump talking about first Mike Kaufman of Colorado and then Mia Love of Utah, both of whom lost or appear to be on their way to losing their reelection bids this year.
On the other hand, you had some that decided to let's stay away. They did very poorly. Mike Kaufman. Too bad, Mike. Mia Love. But Mia Love gave me no love. And she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia.
Sorry about that, Mia, he says, but Trump doesn't sound very sorry. Later on in his remarks, Trump said that he wasn't sure whether he should be happy or sad about the losses suffered by Republican candidates who distanced themselves from his unpopular presidency. And he concluded that he thinks he feels just fine about it. Now, that's kind of crazy because no president has ever benefited from watching the other party take control of Congress. Certainly, Trump's life would be better for the next 2 years if Republicans, even Republicans that distance themselves from him, were still in control of the House. But I think it reveals in a small way, once again, that Trump really doesn't feel a lot of allegiance to the Republican Party or to its voters or to its candidates. And regardless of how you feel about Trump, I think it's clear that loyalty to him is kind of a one-way street. And in the aftermath of Tuesday's midterm elections, the Republican Party is increasingly and exclusively the party of Trump. It is a party to which he expects members to want to embrace him. Now, to be fair, in an election where literally hundreds of Republicans were elected to Congress, it is not, of course, always true that those who showed the greatest fealty to Trump are the ones who were victorious and those who shunned him were not always defeated. There are plenty of members of both groups that will be present when the 116th Congress begins in January. Still, though, Trump's broad assessment of the Republicans' performance has more than just the ring of truth to it. It's something that's been widely acknowledged by commentators and analysts on the right in the past few days, including the Federalist's Ben Domenech, the Washington Examiner's David Drucker, and the Atlantic's McKay Coppins, among a bunch of others. The specifics of their argument might differ, but the central thesis is basically the same. The Republican Party is now decidedly more Trumpian, as Domenech put it, because of the elimination of many of its more moderate and Trump-critical members. The effect is probably more pronounced, I think, in the Senate, due mostly to the fact that Republicans don't control the agenda in the House anymore, and the fact that the House GOP caucus or conference was already kind of more pro-Trump even before the election. But in the Senate, I think you're going to see a significant change when the new Congress meets in January. Several Republican senators who were thorns in Trump's side are now gone. That includes, of course, the late John McCain, but also Jeff Flake of Arizona and Bob Corker of Tennessee, both of whom are retiring. Marsha Blackburn, who was elected Tuesday to replace Corker in Tennessee, made Trump's endorsement a centerpiece of her campaign. And that, I think, is a fitting analogy for the transformation of the Republican Party that we saw in this midterm on the national stage. But beyond the specifics of who comprises the Senate Republican Conference, Tuesday's outcome also boosts Trump by widening the Senate Republican majority. With what looks like it'll be a 54-seat majority, that means the moderates will have significantly less power to bend the chamber's will. Think about it like this. Senators like Susan Collins or Ben Sasse will have fewer opportunities to play that singular swing vote role that McCain did on the Obamacare repeal or that Jeff Flake did on Kavanaugh's confirmation. Now, when I went back and rewatched Trump's press conference from Wednesday, I was really struck by how deliberate the president's shots at other Republicans were. The comments about Mike Kaufman's loss and the sorry Mia might have been typical Trumpian ad-libbing, but the rest of it is decidedly not. Trump was reading from a card most of the time, including the moment when he pretty helpfully laid out exactly what it means to be embracing Trumpism. This was not Trump talking off the cuff or making fun of political opponents, as he's done plenty of times before. This was a deliberate strategy by the White House to convey a specific message to Republicans. And that message is that Trump is now the center of the party, the center of conservatism, for better or for worse. I think it's also telling that one of the strongest rebukes of Trump's comments about love came from Representative Ryan Costello, a Republican from Pennsylvania, who tweeted after the press conference that he was disgusted by Trump's performance. Later in the day on CNN, he stood by those comments and clarified that he believed that many moderate Republicans made the right choice to distance themselves from Trump, who is deeply unpopular in some parts of the country, and that doing so was really the only chance they had at winning re-election, even if they ultimately failed to win re-election. The president's unpopularity, Costello said, was a deciding factor in some of those races that Republicans could have won but instead lost. But Costello's opinion may not carry too much weight, especially with the White House, because like so many other Trump-skeptical Republicans, well, he won't be there in January. He didn't seek re-election. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm.
A clash of ideologies. That is what will take place as the United States enters an era of divided government. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, offers his thoughts on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In the past 2 years, there has been a rapid acceleration of the polarization in the political landscape. The 2016 election of Donald Trump as president has reinforced the divide, with the left refusing to accept the results of the election. Yet in 2016, the nation spoke loudly and clearly that the traditional institutions of the bureaucracy were not serving the people that elected them. Political rhetoric for almost 10 years prior to the 2016 election vilified conservatives. Obama's comments about Trump supporters clinging to their guns and religion reverberated throughout middle America. His comments in 2015 picked at the scab of the wound inflicted by Obama on the nation's heartland when he made it initially in 2008. In 2018, elections in many Democratic primaries pushed their candidates further to the left, embracing socialism, just as Republicans and conservatives were embracing free markets. Maxine Waters' chance to impeach President Trump ran an endless streak of anger towards the president and the ideals he supports. Finally, the Senate spectacle relating to the confirmation hearings with Justice Kavanaugh perhaps exemplifies most the divide now splitting our nation. It may be the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. The divide splitting our nation is being played out in so many different ways. Examples of where the crisis is likely to explode include the discord over the Electoral College, the Me Too movement versus Mama Bear's movement, as exemplified by the presumption of innocence versus the assumption of guilt, personal accountability versus victim mentality, and entitlement versus self-determination. The left has been clamoring for an elimination of the Electoral College because of the popular vote victories by Democrats in two presidential elections since 2000. The National Popular Vote Compact, in which a state passes a law that requires its Electoral College votes to be cast according to the results of the national election. So far, 11 states and the District of Columbia, comprising 172 electoral votes of the 270 needed, have already signed on to the compact. The purpose of the Electoral College was to prevent the large states from abusing the smaller states. In all likelihood, the United States would not have come to be had it not been for the Electoral College proposed by James Madison as a compromise. Should more states decide to join the National Popular Vote movement, thereby potentially avoiding a constitutional amendment requirement, the fundamental nature of our federal system of government will be undermined and likely lead to more constitutional challenges of the movement. The Judge Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the sad impact on Dr. Ford have now pitted the Me Too movement against a growing Mama Bear movement, sickened by the lack of due process and allegations involving misconduct. A major underpinning of our legal system is a presumption of innocence. Unfortunately, due to the difficulty of these cases, mere accusations of sexual misconduct destroy the lives of the innocent and replace the presumption of innocence with an assumption of guilt. This distinction is creating a moral divide in this nation of unparalleled consequences. This problem would be relatively easy to fix by protecting the names of the alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator until the results of a grand jury or district attorney are published. Unfortunately, the divide in the nation is so great that such a common sense solution is unlikely. The character of a nation and its core values determine whether or not a nation will survive. A core value is your philosophy about your way of life. The core value is your character, your leadership, and your upbringing frame of reference. In Western civilization, directly or indirectly relate back to Judeo-Christian principles. A law is not always a core value. A law generally is minimally accepted standard within a society. Laws generally have some basis in core values, but the law is not the desired standard for a normally functioning society. A law is intended to be followed. A core value is intended to be lived. Central to any national character is for the person to accept personal accountability for their actions. Victimization is the exact opposite of taking responsibility. This perspective of victimization plays out through our entire society today. We've become a culture in which we are not responsible for our behaviors. The significance of this debate is quite simple. If you undermine a nation's core values, you undermine the nation. Finally, our grand social experiment called America is at risk over the distinction between entitlement versus self-determination. The political process and government have caused a great deal of this problem by allowing politicians the authority to tax and win re-election by promising to give more of other people's money. With a debt of over $21 trillion in the United States, we may be running out of other people's money, potentially triggering an impasse between the right and the left. Any one of these issues is likely to be a trigger to an even greater national crisis of conscience, perhaps even dividing the nation completely. The battle lines are formed and must be taken very seriously if this grand experiment in liberty is to be preserved, if our newfound economic prosperity is to continue, and if our nation is in fact to survive. Get involved. Get active. Let your voice be heard. Hashtag worth saving. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WRXC-FM in State College, Pennsylvania, WGFP-AM in Webster, Massachusetts, along with FortWorthBeachRadio.com in Fort Worth, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.